On the night of Easter Sunday, I tuned in with 9 million other people to watch NBC's broadcast of Jesus Christ Superstar live in concert, starring John Legend as Jesus, Sarah Bareilles as Mary Magdalene, Alice Cooper as Herod, and Brandon Victor Dixon as Judas. It was spectacular. I fell in love with Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice's musical rock opera in middle school when my Sunday school teacher showed us the 1973 movie with Ted Neely and Carl Anderson and Yvonne Elliman. According to a story in Time magazine, the first versions of Superstar were unauthorized musicals put on by churches in order to stir up their congregations. The musical has always been highly controversial. Jesus' relationship with Mary Magdalene was overly romantic. King Herod was originally in drag. Judas was typically played by a black actor, and his frustrations with Jesus seemed to mirror the black community's impatience with the white church and its lack of engagement with justice for the poor and oppressed. Judas wanted Jesus to be a political revolutionary and believed that his superstar celebrity status or divinity was distracting people from his teachings. However, the most controversial element of all in the musical is the ending, because it has no resurrection. Christianity Today originally complained that there was no faith and no victory in the music, which was haunting and hollow. And they expressed the hope that some Christian composer would come along one day and take a cue from the rock opera about Christ that ends not with hollow questions, but with triumphant answers. During a sermon in June of 71, Billy Graham proudly claimed that some people in Kansas City got a hold of the rock opera and carried it right on to the next step by performing a resurrection. But both Christianity Today and Billy Graham seemed to miss the theological point of the musical. The reason they told the story from Judas' point of view is to leave us wondering, questioning if Jesus really was who they said he was. It was never intended to offer a coherent narrative that ties everything up at the end with easy answers. Instead, Superstar is about the life and death of Jesus, telling a very human story about the personal, emotional struggles and political realities that we all experience. In the Washington Post, after the musical, Hank Stuever said, "Though I would have not put it past NBC to tack on a rolling away of the stone in these cowardly times we live in, they wisely did not. Because when Jesus Christ Superstar is done right, it stirs the audience in such a way that they themselves feel risen. It's sort of a resurrection of the inner spirit." Rejecting the resurrection like Superstar did is spiritually important, especially if the only version of it that we have is the traditional, bright and shiny, glossed over, saccharine, sentimental and polished version. Like all great works of art, Superstar helps us get behind the myths and the metaphors and the meanings that we've inscribed to the story so that we can encounter the resurrection again as if for the first time. It ends a lot like the Gospel of Mark, and the women ran away from the tomb and told nothing because they were afraid. Or later, "But they heard, when they heard that he was alive and been seen by her, they would not believe it. And then again, they went back and told the rest, but they did not believe them." The original ending of the Gospel of Mark and all the endings that were added later seemed to conclude with fear, silence, and disbelief. A very human ending. But then comes verse 14. And things go from strange to outright crazy. The risen Jesus finally shows up in person, and he's not very friendly. Instead of compassionately working with one doubting disciple like Thomas in the Gospel of John, Jesus encounters 11 doubting disciples. And all of the disciples in Mark are living in disbelief, and the first thing Jesus does when he encounters them is upbraid them for their lack of faith and stubbornness. He didn't say, "Hi guys, nice to see you again," or "I missed you," or "April Fools," or "Peace be upon you," or "Feed my sheep," or wait in here in Jerusalem for the Spirit to come. He upbraided them and scolded them and reproached them. I don't know about you, but if the resurrection means we will be encountered by a scolding and reproaching Jesus, then I'll stick with the original ending of the Gospel of Mark. Why all the judgment, Jesus? Can you really blame these disciples for not believing a dead body was raised? Can you really blame them for doubting and being stubborn after all that they had experienced? The poet Christian Wiman speaks about doubt. He says that the Gospels vary quite a bit in their accounts of Jesus' resurrection and the ensuing encounters that he had with other people. But they are quite consistent about one thing. Many of his followers doubted, sometimes even when Jesus was staring them in the face. He says this ought to be heartening for those of us who seek to believe. If the disciples could doubt not only firsthand accounts of his resurrection, but the very fact of his face in front of them, then clearly doubt has little to do with distance from the events. Wiman goes on to say that doubt in some way is the seed of Christianity planted in the very heart, and it must be torn terribly and wondrously open in order to flower into a living faith. We may think, he says, that it would be a great deal easier to believe if the world erupted around us, if a Savior came down and offered us the evidence of his body scars in his side. But what the Gospel suggests is that this is not only wishful thinking, but willful blindness. For in fact, the world is erupting all around us. And Christ is often offering us the scars in his side. Doubt is not the problem. But what we often call doubt is not the absence of faith at all, but faith that is latent in lives that we are not quite living. God dormant in the world to which we are not quite giving our best selves. Many of you are probably ready to reject the resurrection that we get here in the Gospel of Mark. Most of us would much rather have the Jesus Christ superstar ending over these weird stories that we heard today. But before we dismiss the editor of Mark's Gospel too quickly, we must ask the question, why did Jesus upbraid the disciples? Was it for not believing that he had been raised from the dead? Was it for not believing in the doctrine of resurrection? If you look closely, the text clearly says Jesus reproached them because they did not believe those who saw him after he had risen. So Jesus wasn't upset because the disciples didn't believe in him. He was upset because they didn't believe in each other. Jesus wasn't upset about an intellectual problem. He was upset about a relational problem. By rejecting the good news Mary Magdalene and the two companions had shared about what they encountered and what they'd experienced, the disciples were not rejecting an idea. They were rejecting people. And not just any people, but the very friends who they had followed with Jesus and had shared life with for so long. Jesus was disappointed by their lack of faith in each other. A little knowledge of the Greek is a game changer for this story. The word faith doesn't mean belief the way we think it does. It means something more like faithfulness or trust or loyalty. As Walter Brueggemann says, fidelity. In both Greek and Latin, it's always an expression of a relational commitment, not a theology. Faith is a covenant, not a thought or idea. Jesus was upset about their faithfulness to one another. The violence and the trauma of the cross had divided the community, and they were no longer able to trust one another. They certainly didn't trust Mary or the two companions on the road, but they didn't trust each other either. In addition, the word that is translated stubborn in our NRSV translation is sclerocardia. It has the word cardia in it, you might have noticed, which means heart. And so the literal translation for sclerocardia is not stubborn, but hardness of heart. Jesus wasn't irritated by their, not just irritated by their loss of trust and lack of fidelity to one another, but disturbed by how their hearts had become hardened. The loss of Jesus had not only broken their trust, it had broken their hearts, closed them off, made them calloused and cold, and left them with hearts of stone. These 11 disciples should have been able to trust their fellow disciples, but their hearts couldn't trust anyone anymore. With all the brokenness and scandal and injustice we see among Christians today, both Christianity and the church are things that are getting harder and harder to trust and believe in. It's hard to trust Christians because we don't have a really great track record. In fact, you could easily argue that it is a lot harder to believe in the church these days than it is to believe in someone raising from the dead. It's harder to believe in Jesus' followers than it is to believe in Jesus. There's that quote often attributed to Gandhi, "I like your Christ, but I do not like your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Christ." The quote actually appears to be from an Indian philosopher named Bara Dada, who said, "Jesus is ideal and wonderful, but you Christians are not like him." Wouldn't it be nice if we could have Jesus without his followers? Wouldn't it be nice if we could have Christ without Christians, Jesus without the church? It would make things so much simpler. But as much as we would like to have Christ without Christians, we cannot. They are inextricable. The gospel was not for individuals. It was for a people, a community. Jesus called people to follow and gathered a community around him for a reason. Because following Jesus is not about learning a new philosophy of ideas. It is about discovering a way of life that must be lived out in community with other people. Early in the novel Les Miserables by Victor Hugo, he portrays the fall of his main character, Jean Valjean, as a common laborer who's sentenced to 5 years in prison for stealing a loaf of bread to feed his starving family. Once he's released from jail, no one will give Valjean any work or sell him any food or provide any shelter because of his criminal record, and he becomes increasingly cynical and jaded about humanity. Eventually, he convinces himself that there are no good people left in the world anymore. And so one night, hopeless, exhausted, and hungry and looking for food, Valjean stumbles into the house of an old bishop who welcomes him and strangely treats him as an honored guest. Valjean is so confused by the bishop's generosity that he rejects it. It can't be genuine. And so he steals 2 silver plates from the bishop just to get out of the house. The next morning, of course, the police arrive at the bishop's house with the captured criminal Valjean in their custody, along with the silver plates that he stole. But to the astonishment of both the thief and the police, the bishop says, "My friend, I'm so glad to see you. Remember, I gave you the candlesticks yesterday, too. Why didn't you take them along with the plates?" Completely dumbfounded, Valjean opened his eyes and looked up at the bishop with an expression no human tongue could describe. And with no evidence before them, the police were forced to release their captive. And the bishop then hands Valjean the candlesticks and sends him off with a blessing. He says, "Jean Valjean, my brother, you no longer belong to evil, but to good. It is your soul that I am buying back for you. I am withdrawing it from all the dark thoughts, and I give it today to God." In that moment, Valjean was reborn. And the rest of Les Miserables is the story of the new reality that he is able to live into as a result of his encounter with the faith and the forgiveness of this bishop. But Jean Valjean's problem wasn't that he didn't believe in God. His problem was that he had lost the ability to trust other people. He couldn't believe that someone could be as generous and peaceful and forgiving and as honest as the bishop. And I think that's the disciples' problem too. The inhumanity and the evil of the cross had caused them to lose their faith in humanity. Like Valjean, their hearts had become hard and they lost their ability to trust their closest friends, and they were living like they were already dead. Nora Gallagher wrote a memoir once about her struggle with grief following the death of her brother to cancer. And in it, she describes the profound sense of loss that she felt when her brother died. It was so powerful that she didn't know what to do with it and couldn't figure out how to move on with her life. And after a few tough years, she began to realize that she had not only lost her brother, But she had lost her own way in the world. Her brother's death had become her own death. And so in a desperate attempt to find her way again, she began returning back to all the places where she and her brother had spent time together. And she thought that this journey was a way for her to search for her brother. But even though she never found him along the way, she found herself again. And she discovered she wasn't really looking for her brother to be raised from the dead or restored to her at all. What she was really looking for was to be restored to herself, to find her own resurrection. In describing her resurrection, Nora says this now. Now when I think about Easter, I don't just think about what happened to Jesus anymore at all. I think about what happened to his close friends and followers. Something profound happened to them too. It was not only what they saw when they encountered the risen Jesus, but what was set free in them personally. The resurrection appearances give way to something even more important than the truth of God's vindication of Jesus. They prove that we too can come alive again. Resurrection means that a new pattern of events has been set free all around us, and that just like Jesus, we too can be raised from the dead in this life. Sometimes, she says, we spend so much time in the church believing or not believing in the resurrection that we miss the point. The resurrection is not just about the appearance of Jesus alone. The point is what they ask of us. It's not what we think about them, but what we do with them that really matters. We can either make them into superstitions, or we can use them as stepping stones to new life. We can simply believe in the resurrection, or we can practice resurrection ourselves. What if resurrection is not a belief, but a practice we engage in together as a people on a journey of faith? Jesus worked hard to create a community of followers. At his arrest, they abandoned him. At his trial, they denied him. At his death, they were broken and scattered. But after 3 days, he appeared to that same community of followers in order to bring them back together again. The purpose of the resurrection appearances were not just to reconcile the disciples to Jesus, who they had abandoned and denied, but to reconcile the disciples to one another, to restore the community of faith, to reestablish trust in each other, to empower them then to go out and become ministers of reconciliation by fulfilling Jesus' mission in the world. And that mission was to unfold the kingdom of God, to cultivate a new creation, to build a beloved community. And then Jesus said, of course, that some very strange signs would accompany his followers in this work. They would cast out demons, speak in new tongues, pick up snakes with their hands, drink poison and not be hurt, lay hands on the sick and recover. Some of our Baptist brethren took this snake handling thing a little bit too far. But Jesus was likely recasting a vision of the peaceful kingdom from Isaiah 11, where it says, "The wolf shall live with the lamb, and the child shall play over the hole of the snake, and shall put its hand over the adder's den." All the signs that Jesus mentioned are signs of life and peace. Life and peace overcoming the power of violence and death. They are signs of the power of the resurrection, signs of the mission that we are called to as the followers of Jesus. As scholar Brian Blunt says, we are on a mission. We are on an invasive mission to strike life into this death-occupied, death-obsessed, death-wearied world. He says, so I'm telling you, rise up off your pew and rise out into resurrection. But we cannot do the work of resurrection alone, can we? That's why believing in each other matters so much, because our mission depends on it. We are called to be Easter people, but if we can't trust each other, we will continue to live on the other side of Easter, hiding safely behind locked doors. If we can't have faith in each other, then we will remain huddled in the dark, living in fear, threatened by everyone and everything around us. Jesus appeared to the disciples to teach them that we have to trust each other if we are going to live and work together to build a new world. We cannot spend all our time questioning each other's motives, doubting each other's dedication, thinking the worst when we fail to live up to each other's own personal spiritual expectations. That kind of radical suspicion breaks communities apart. Doubting and distrusting one another will only serve to tear at the very fabric of who we are as a people. If we are going to become Easter people, then we have to stop distrusting our friends. We have to be courageous. We have to unlock the doors and step out into the world together again and take the risk of community. If we're going to be Easter people, then we have to realize we can't do it alone. We have to work together. And to do that effectively, we have to listen to our friends. We have to have faith in the community. We have to trust each other. We have to believe in each other. We have to have our hearts open wide to each other. We have to love one another. It may not seem like the easiest thing to do, but somewhere along the way, the first disciples figured it out. And that means there may be hope for us as well. Doubt and disbelief are not the enemy of faith or the enemy of Easter. Death is the true enemy. And the destruction and dissension and division that it causes in communities of people. But Jesus overcame death by returning to his disciples, reconciling them to one another and saying, "Look, if you want new life, you have to do it together." The power of resurrection can only be born in our relationships within a community. But we have been given an awesome job. The awesome job of bringing each other back to life. And then going out to reconcile the world. And all we have to be to do that is stubborn enough to never let go of each other. As we get up, rise up off of our pews and rise out into resurrection. Amen.